All right, you curious, you courageous hurly-burlyites. One of my favorite things about this gig is the panel conversations we put together here on the pod. I think they're unique conversations with a level of experience and depth of thinking all too rare these days in media. This series is one of my favorites. The Chiefs are back, making their fifth appearance here on the Hurly Burly. You remember these guys, three former chiefs of staff to some of Canada's most accomplished heads of government. Ian Brody, first chief of staff to Stephen Harper and central to the founding of the CPC, now professor of political science at the University of Calgary. Brian Topp, former chief of staff to Rachel Notley in Alberta, deputy chief to Roy Romano in Saskatchewan, one of the architects of Jack Layton's Orange Wave. Today, he's a founding partner at GT & Company. And Tim Murphy, former chief of staff to Paul Martin, now CEO and managing partner of Macmillan LLP. So we struck this panel to discuss the issues from the unique perspective of chiefs of staff who juggle both politics and substance, have to run the government and, in a sense, run the party. So today, 7 days after the federal budget and its suite of measures, we'll do a situation assessment of the government and the various parties. So all the governing grist you could ever want packed into the next hour. Tim, Ian, Brian, you're busy people. Thanks for making the time today to have this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Good to see you.
Always good to see you guys. All right, so the recent budget had to do two things. It had to be a solid financial blueprint for the country that kept to some fiscal parameters and dealt with some pressing issues like housing and productivity. It also had to be a political strategy that could vault the Liberals back into political contention. Tim, how do you think they struck that balance?
Well, I guess we don't know is the short answer. If measures equal popularity, there's lots of measures that in theory should be able to move the yardsticks for them. That's the real question, though. Is it too late? Is the die too cast? I think is the broader political question. But no, you look at this budget, there was, it's kind of an Oprah Winfrey budget, right? You get a car and you get a car and you get a car and all really focused around, they put it right in the title, right? Millennials and Gen Z trying to move back a voter pool that had been, at least over the last year, lost to them. I thought the rollout in advance of the budget of a bunch of measures was well done, to provide a sustained focus on housing in particular as an issue. Yep. So I think if you took the raw polling and said, where are we unpopular and why, they had something to say on everything. Frankly, it felt a bit like a budget written by a campaign team as opposed to a government in truth. And there are a bunch of little things in there I know that are very riding specific, like, Windsor got an urban park in this. Like, well, why would that all have a seat there? I get it. I'm going on a bit long, but I think the challenge, I think, is in one of these podcasts, we talked about how the strategy for the government seemed to be, they were going to walk for a year through the valley of shadow of death and hope to come out the other side. And I guess somewhere through that stroll, they realized they better do something other than just walk. And this is an attempt to do that. To your opening line, I think, yes, there's stuff on housing. Yes, there's stuff on millennial and Gen Z concerns. Can it move the yardsticks? I don't know. Not much on productivity, frankly. I don't think it's not a roadmap for a more productive economy. Fiscal, look, there's going to be, stuff in there you could point to that's sort of fiscal, but they kind of missed every estimate that they've put in any of these documents. So overall, I think it's got stuff in it they can sell. I just worry that the audience may have stopped listening.
Ian, what's your take on their attempt to accomplish those two objectives, a good budget and a political budget?
I thought, as far as the political wraparound of the budget, as Tim says, the sort of the pre-announcements before budget day, and then the kind of the political framing of the budget document itself and the speech, this was as good an effort as this government can do. I mean, I think it was whoever did all the execution bits of it did it well. Nonetheless, the substance of the budget does kind of read like a last budget of a government. I mean that in two senses. One, there's a lot of grasping, as Tim says, a car for every constituency, an urban park for every target riding, which is fine. This is a tried and true method. It's not clear to me that anybody's paying attention to any of that. And the challenge now is to really, having made the announcements, to hammer through the benefits that these are going to have for whoever the intended population is, whatever segment of the voters it is. But I mean a last budget in another sense, but the fiscal risks that the government's running here, in particular with the fiscal risks the U.S. government's running in the background, does read like a government that desperately isn't planning to get reelected, because at some point all of those fiscal risks are going to come back at some point to bite them, and you're laying landmines for, who knows, 2027, 2028, 2029. They're hoping it's after the next election. And I didn't get the sense there was anything in this budget that looks ahead to managing what those risks will look like after the election has come and gone. I think also the part of their problem is on measures like the capital gains tax increase and some other pieces here. This really is a 12-month budget. You might as well take out your X-Acto knife and cut off the page all of the projections that go beyond the next budget, because they're just fiction. I mean, they're complete. I don't mean that they were badly done by the finance department people. I mean, the people who do those projections, I think they know what they're doing, and I'm not suggesting they were in any way unprofessional, but they're based on policy assumptions, policy announcements that have a huge question mark over them, have huge political risk analysis wrapped around them. And so any consumer of this budget outside of government who's reading that and is looking at the projections for 2027, 2028, or the 2028, 2029 fiscal year, nobody outside of the finance minister's office, and even then I assume half the people in the finance minister's office, are not paying any attention to those at all. This is the problem, is that in some of the issues that you identified, like productivity, frankly, Canadian governments have had trouble with this issue going back two generations now. We've been through at least three cycles of policy efforts to grapple with the productivity problem. You do need kind of long-term believability of your policy measures in order to have even a modest amount of influence on that, if the government can do anything about it at all, and count me as skeptical on that. And so I'm not sure, given that, say, all of the out years, as they say at the finance department, on this projection or the policy framework are being discounted to zero by everybody outside of government, I'm not sure that was going to have any kind of impact anyway.
All right. Brian, do you think they should be happy with their work?
Well, look, I want to riff off two things you said there. So first of all, you asked, is it too late? The answer is no, it's not too late. I know I think I said this on another show that we were on recently. We recently had a state funeral, say goodbye to my friend Ed Broadbent, and that was an occasion to think about his career. And one of the interesting things about Ed Broadbent was that about a year and a half before the 1988 election, he was going to be Prime Minister of Canada. He was in the mid-40s in the polls, by far and away the most popular federal politician. Everybody loved him. He was being profiled in the New York Times, when the fall of the Mulroney government and its replacement by the Broadbent government was inevitable. But that didn't, alas, for Canada, turn out to be the case. And so there's plenty of time. As Neil saw, a week is a long time in politics. A year to a year and a half in politics is a long time. There's time for the politics to change. The second thing you said was, that in the role of the chief of staff, you balance, the need to run government with the need to think about the party. And I got to say, on this budget, it seems to me the government side won and the party side got killed. And it seems like to me, like as I look at the budget, that it's a classic example of progressive governmentitis. And what I mean by that is, progressives, when they're in government, love government. They love the complexity of government, and they love all the things that you can do with government, and they want to share everything that they've learned and all the fun of it all with the public. And you can see when progressive governmentitis rots the brain of progressive parties or parties that are trying to frame themselves as progressives, because what you do is, when you are off doing politics, like, for example, the very smart and well-conceived pre-budget tour that the Prime Minister, the Deputy Prime Minister, was on, that what you do is you go around and every day you announce a new 10 to 15 point plan. And you go, look at this, look at all this wonderful stuff that we have come up with. And you talk about it once and then you move on, because you have so many other wonderful plans that you can talk about. And that's what this budget is. It is an unending round of 15-point plans, and I don't think that the public heard any of it. Here's a case in point. In part because of the well-considered, if troubling in its detail, effort of the official opposition. A lot of people care about housing, in particular the Gen Z people that you were talking about. There's a big and good idea in this budget, okay? A really good idea, which is that a big piece of capital that governments control, municipal, provincial, and federal, is land. And governments have a lot of public land. That's a very important piece of capital, as opposed to borrowing hundreds of millions of dollars to do lots of construction. You can make a lot of housing happen by the terms under which you make public land available for housing. That's a really big idea. And it's, well, there's some interesting stuff in the budget about it. It's buried in a 13-point plan. It's like 0.7 or something like that in a 13-point plan. Nobody heard it. Okay, nobody has heard it. They saw that the prime minister and the deputy minister were out talking, but nobody heard it. So their task, if this is going to go anywhere, is they need to take this gigantic, you know, Mount Everest, the 15-point plans, and turn it into something that a voter can understand. And if they can do that, then there's plenty, way too much to work with in there to put together, an appeal to voters. We'll see if it works, and we'll see what the other parties do. And just one other thing, you know, there's some other business that they did in there that nobody's talking about because it doesn't seem to matter to anybody, but it is worth noting when you ask, what do you think of the budget? First of all, and I'm saying this a little against type, they're trying to be a little bit more serious about defense in a circumstance in which, the international events are troubling in a 1936 kind of way. That was the right thing to do. It's a pity that they don't talk to the public about it. And secondly, it looks like, if I understand correctly, like there were some pretty serious reinvestments in First Nations people. And given the continued, you know, completely unacceptable levels of poverty in those communities, that's always the right thing.
Right. Can I stay with you for a sec? There's one thing that they clearly want out of this budget is a fight over the capital gains tax. They want a fight over the capital gains tax. And so far, the conservatives aren't giving them one. And the business community is not really rushing to the barricades on this matter. So what kind of fight do they need, and how can they still have it?
Yeah, well, look, I think the thing about the capital gains fight, which is just going back to the way it was in the 90s, right, when it was at 75%, I don't think anybody understands it, other than it sounds like you have to give the government more money when you sell the family cottage, which people who own cottages don't like. So again, they have picked, we're back in the world of progressive governmentitis here. Like people who care about tax policy care a lot about the capital gains, but nobody else knows what the hell you're talking about. And so I see what they were trying to
do. I'm sure you lose people right at inclusion rate. I'm sure that's a term that most people are not familiar with.
It's like what? Right. Most people don't go anywhere near this piece of the tax. That's why they picked it. It's because most people don't go anywhere near this part of the tax code. But as a result, nobody knows what you're talking about. and because it was, dropped once, and back to my point about, you know, nobody heard it because you only did it once. And the Tories aren't biting. It's gone over badly with a clientele that the Tories aren't interested in hugging right now. The common sense of the common people is not that rich people should pay lower taxes. That's not what's on the mind of the common sense of the common people. And so they're not biting. And so, the Liberals, I don't think, got the fight that they were hoping for. Ian points to some productivity arguments that are being made by people in the business community that is in part about this. And that's technically interesting, but politically, I think it's just a wash because nobody knows what they're talking about.
Ian, do the Conservatives not have to respond to this? They can just ignore it?
Yes. to be blunt, yes. For all the reasons that Brian set out. Look, you and Tim and I go back to a fight about income trusts and the taxation of income trusts, about which, mea culpa, by the way, on the Conservative side, we got awfully... wrapped up about after you guys got wrapped up about it. Well, Brian was there too. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, of course. Yes, this is we're also old here. We remember the income trust fight. in the end, you know, it has an impact on people who use that form of taxation to try to structure their corporate taxes. The capital gains will be probably a little bit bigger than that. But my sense is in the business community of the folks who would be attuned to, you know, who know what the inclusion rate is. I mean, I'm from a family of accountants, so I grew up on inclusion rates, but at the dinner table, but most people aren't. So for in the business community, for people who kind of understand the fine-tuned distinctions between a 50% and a 35% inclusion rate and the $1 to $1.25 million lifetime, blah, 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 they're worried about a lot of other things in addition to the capital gains tax. They're worried about a hostility to investment. They're worried about world leaders coming and asking, pleading for long-term natural gas deals with Canada and a government that says there's no business case based on, I'm not sure what their analysis is, but they don't think there's a business case. And multiply that times 1,000 other concerns. So the folks who are worried about the inclusion rate on the capital gains piece have reason to want rid of the Trudeau government for 1,000 other reasons. That gives Mr. Poilievre and the Conservatives tremendous latitude to decide where they want to attack the government and where they don't want to attack the government on this one. Look, I don't see that this budget has changed Poilievre's top line, one of four or five arguments in his YouTube ads for replacing the government at all. And I think that's an indication that the government's budget was not aimed at trying to pull back or to disrupt Mr. Poilievre's election campaign strategy at all. It was fighting other fights with other parties for other groups of the electorate. And I understand that, but I don't think Poilievre paid any attention to the budget at all.
Tim, would you abandon this fight now, or would you find? I mean, they wanted they're the rich folks, and we're for the next generation. Do you think that they can, in any way, salvage that fight, or they just have to wait for next year and find a better bait?
So, I also think, I think a fight with the Conservatives over this was gravy. I think actually underpinning this, if you look at kind of. Step. I don't know if you know the Frank Bruni book, The Age of Grievance, about the New York Times columnist, about the analysis of kind of, you know, we're all now looking at the world from the perspective of if you win, I lose, a zero-sum game. We all have grievances. And if you looked at some of the polling about, you know, millennials, Gen Zs, the younger voters, who were important constituency historically for the Trudeau Liberals, they share this view, and so they view rich people and boomers having assets and capital and opportunity that's being deprived of them. So it's a bit of, I want them to pay and me to get, right? I mean, I don't mean to be unfair, but I think there was an element of that, I need to see them pay and me get as part of the attitude. And I think a bit of what was in the budget was trying to dig into that, to say, we're going to make some of those rich people pay, and part of that is going to support the housing. So it is appealing to that electorate. Would a fight over this issue with the Conservatives been a good thing to have? I think probably they hope for that, although I kind of agree with Ian that it was a bit of a vain hope. I mean, we've got, you know, Poilievre's been very successful on the Dr. Seuss strategy, right? It's, you know, axe the tax, you know, one house, two house, good night, moon. I don't even know what his slogans are, but that's all it is, right? And he doesn't appear to need to do anything else. So I think it was kind of gravy to have that fight and to think they have it. But I do think it was structured around this notion that we have two stories we need to tell to those voters. One, we have a whole slew of things that we're doing for you. And I kind of agree with Brian that it was almost too many. Like, it doesn't punch through if it's too many. But also we're making some of those people who are hanging on to it for too long with too much, we're making them pay a bit too. Even if it's confusing, the notion that taxes are going up on people who have is a narrative that's helpful in that group. So I do think, now, look, I just want, if I can, David, pick up a bit on Brian's point about that kind of, isn't government wonderful and all the great things we can do if you're, you know, going in, if you don't think government's a bad thing, you enjoy using government. I think there's no question there's some of that in this budget. And part of it is, although I think it undermined the potential of a bigger deal, right? Like, if you really wanted to kind of change the narrative, was there a world in which you say we're going to, like, can we deliver a middle-class tax cut in this context as part of a productivity analysis? Or some, you know, some big story in which we rejig the tax system to allow, look, the Harper did it to government by lowering the GST a couple of points, denying it of the lifeblood of tax revenue. Could you have done something big and say, look, because at the end of the day, what's the best way to thing to tax consumption? What do rich people buy more? Consumer stuff. And you basically say anyone below a certain point, you actually don't have to pay GST. Everyone else has to pay more.
I'm a boy born of the prairies, and I've worked a lifetime in politics and polling. From these experiences, Hurley Burleyites, I can tell you unequivocally, the West is not the East. Ah, you're smart. You know that. For a few weeks now, I've been talking about CRTC hearings, exploring options for mandating wholesale fiber internet to the premises. Should they do it? If so, where? And how to do it in a way that best promotes competition, so Canadians have choice and affordability. Our presenting sponsor, TELUS, presented at those hearings. One of their key points? Well, the West is not the East. Or one broad national mandate does not fit all regions equally. Evidence backs it up. As a result of the pre-existing mandates on copper and cable in Western Canada, subscribers to services provided by wholesalers have increased out there by 17% in the last 2 years. Competition in the West is flourishing in ways it simply is not in the East. Layer onto that, labor costs are 12% more expensive in Alberta and BC, how dispersed the population is, the mountainous terrain, and that fiber has to be buried in Alberta, making the network a hell of a lot more expensive to build, and the maxim holds true. Say it with me. The West is not the East. So, a short recap. A much more competitive landscape. Far higher costs to invest. Oh, and one last caution. There's been a fair bit of change in the West recently, with other policies and a major industry merger only a year old. The competitive realities are just beginning to take hold. So the CRTC would be wise to understand how any new mandate in the West would stack on top of those policies, eh? As for TELUS, they believe different regional conditions require a specifically tailored mandate before further intervention is settled on. All right, that's it. Stay tuned next week, Hurley Burleyites, for The North is Not the South. Kidding.
To Brian's point, the opportunity to do a big thing was there. And I think being trapped in the fun of playing with the various tools government gave you and being in government for as long as they had made it very difficult to try the big thing in the context of where I think they actually need a big thing to move the numbers.
Right.
Can I just add one last point on this tax thing?
Yeah.
They did this a lot better in 2015. And I can register a grievance here because I think that it was a bit of a lift for Rachel Notley in her campaign. So first Rachel Notley in her campaign, and then shortly thereafter, Mr. Trudeau went around talking about the scissors that you're talking about and that Tim just basically talked about. And they said, look, it's time for people to get a helping hand. It's time, framed in slightly different ways. And to do this, the people who did best during the economic crisis we've just gone through, contribute just a little bit more so that everybody else can be okay. In a circumstance in which they've done very, very well for the last 20 to 25 years, now they can contribute a little bit more. Like, people got that, We are changing the inclusion rate. Nobody gets that.
Right. Well, I guess the low-hanging fruit maybe was gone. They were constrained. I think they wanted a bigger budget. I think their political strategy called for a bigger budget than they produced, but they were constrained, I think, by either the fisc or various things.
Look, David, Harper went through this before 2015, right? Remember, the election was in the fall of 2015, so there was a budget in the spring of 2015, which was a big, name something from the 2015 budget. I cannot. And so in the fall of 2014, in the big fall economic update, I think the Harper government went through $25 billion worth of measures, and the finance guys went through every line in the fiscal framework, all 250,000 of them, and they went back to the same things that we ran on in 2006: kids, ballet, dance, recital, tax credit, transit pass, whatever the hell. They blew through a ton of money. It didn't add up to much in the way of marketing. As a result, as Tim said, each new detail drowned out the previous good detail or plausible detail. And they left themselves in the spring of 2015 without much room in the fiscal framework left for the pre-budget or pre-election push. It was poorly planned. It was poorly executed. And I have a sense that's the same problem that's taken place here. Hmm.
Ian, can I stick with you, though? On the Conservatives riding through this carbon, capital gains tax thing. Right. So I know that there's no expectation that they're going to release a platform early, and they certainly don't need to show all their cards early. But don't they have to start talking a little more normally to people? So I saw Conservative spokespeople, members of Parliament, on shows where they were asked, what's your position going to be on this capital gains tax change? And they would say, our program is we're going to ax the tax, we're going to build the homes, we're going to stop the crime, and we're going to fix the budget. I'm not kidding. They literally say this.
Yes.
Right? So, I mean, they have a lot of people supporting them now who weren't supporting them a year ago. Don't they still have to impress those people?
They have to impress those people on election day, David. So, as I keep telling my conservative friends in Ottawa, let's be clear. The Conservatives won the 2023 federal general election. The only problem was 2023 was not a federal general election year. If there'd been an election, boy, that would have been a fantastic blowout for the ages. Mr. Morney's record of 1984 might have been at risk. The only problem is, damn it, Trudeau didn't call an election that year. And so, you know, there's some time yet. My sense is that, I've been in opposition. The government announces a budget. You've got, you know, two guys in the shop who vaguely understand how to make sense of a budget on the staff side and nobody on the caucus side. And I think it's going to take them the summer to figure out, now that the government has sort of cast in its numbers for the next 18 months or whatever, what does the world look like looking forward to the next election, and what do we have to do at that point? I suspect that between now and the next election, there will be some conservative erosion in the polls. But for the time being, I don't think that needs to worry them for the reasons that Brian pointed out. I mean, look, 2.5 years ago, if I'd listened to all the polls here in Alberta, Rachel Notley would be premier of Alberta by now. There was no way even a leadership change was going to change the calculus for the UCP. And lo and behold, the last time I checked, we have a UCP premier. So, you're right. There's some flesh on the bones that's needed over the next little while. But I think, you know, 24 hours after the federal government announces its budget plan for 2024, 2025, when you don't have the finance department, you don't have PCO, and you don't have whatever we've got, 400,000 public servants or whatever it is these days, to churn through the analysis, and you've spent 6 months thinking through the budget and all the different pieces of it, so the moment it's announced, you understand the trade-offs. I don't think any of that's going to really sink through on the conservative side until the fall, and I don't think that's much of a surprise.
Yeah. Brian, Tim, what do you guys think about conservative comms?
I chaired a Toronto mayoralty debate once. We had a whole bunch of the mayoral
lucky
candidates.
Guy.
It was loads of laughs, and we actually got them all to come out to Pinewood Toronto Studios in downtown Toronto and talk about film policy. So a whole bunch of candidates gave us thoughtful statements about how film policy is very important and we need to have more movies coming to Toronto. And then Rob Ford talked. I said, so, Mr. Ford, what do you think about film policy? And he said, you know what I think, Brian? I think it's time for respect for taxpayers. I think it's time to end the gravy train. I think it's time for a change at City Hall. And I looked at him and went, but what about films? And he said, I think it's time to end the gravy train in City Hall and to have respect for taxpayers. You know what? I couldn't remember a word that any of those mayoralty candidates said, but I just quoted him like 10 years or so after that debate, and I remember what he said. And so all this to say, you know, I think that's what the Tories are up to. They're trying to just chant earworms that people will remember. What I'm not sure of is whether people are going to look at that and at the end of the day go, this is a team of people in whom my healthcare, my education, defense policy, climate change, and so on is safe in their hands, because they do sound like children. And at the end of the day, does the public want children running the government of Canada? Maybe they do. You need to be angry, though, to go along with, I like what Tim was saying, they're Dr. Seuss government of Canada. And so that's going to be their problem is, can you keep this up? Okay, can you keep it up for what will have to be 2 years that you're just talking like children? And at the end of the day, the public will buy it. Some universe will buy it, but will a winning plurality buy it? I'm not so sure.
So I guess a couple of things, one of which is a bit contrary to, yeah, I accept the opposition parties don't have the resources to a detailed analysis, but you know what, they could have been ready if they wanted some substantive things to say, fairly quickly. I just don't think, to Brian's point, they want to, or they need to be fair to them. They're at 40% in the polls doing axe the tax, chop the slop, spin the tin, whatever it is, right? And no sign that there's been much deterioration in that number so far. So why would you change the strategy that appears to be working? Plus, I do think, though, you know, I mean, maybe I'm a bit Pollyannish, but at a certain point, I do think the electorate will say, okay, what are we actually getting, right? Like right now, I cannot, to be honest with you, predict a single policy that Pierre Poilievre's team, other than on one, he'll get rid of a carbon tax. But on anything else, I don't actually know. And to Brian's point, at some point, I think the electorate, you know, will turn to that issue and say, what am I actually getting? And I think that's an opportunity for the Liberals to create the doubt, both on a personality basis and a substantive basis. And I have to assume, because part of me, when I looked at this budget in that context, was, you know, this, the reason I said it felt like it written by the political team as opposed to the government team, despite the failings identified here, is because it felt like the government said, we need to actually get back to a level where people think we can win. We need to rejuvenate some of our own support. We need to create a potential upswing for us. So we need to have some narrative that makes, you know, liberal universe of voters think that we're an alternative that can succeed. What I don't know is then what's the next budget about? What I don't actually get is why the government then came out and said our strategy is to get, you know, 5-point upward swing by July. I mean, I found that kind of astoundingly bizarre to say, you know, here's what we're trying to do, all of this good stuff in a calculated political way, not in a way that was good for Canadians. And secondly, what the heck do you do
for the prime minister, doesn't it?
Well, correct. What the heck do you do if you don't meet that bar? I mean, it just, yeah. I don't know who thought that was smart to leak that, but obviously not. But all that being said, to go back to the point, I just think there's no reason for the Conservatives this far out from an election, in the context of being as popular as they are now, to do a single thing different than that which they're doing.
Right. Remember back in 2008 when Barack Obama said, if you've got a business, you didn't build that? It caused an uproar because in America's culture of rugged individualism, business owners like to think they are entirely self-made. Obama was telling them that they wouldn't exist without public infrastructure built by taxpayers. And so it is here in Canada. Trucking, for example, is highly subsidized simply by the creation and maintenance of public roads. Shipyards are to a great extent wards of the state. Airlines fly out of passenger and freight terminals built by taxpayers, and so forth. Railways, though, are a different matter. They are the titans of our supply chains, and they literally and figuratively pull their own weight. Our sponsor, CN, plows billions in revenue back into its network, building and maintaining tracks and bridges and crossings and rail yards, buying new locomotives and rail cars, and investing in innovative technology to keep its employees and the communities along its network safe. Canadian railways are heavily regulated, but receive little to no public money. The journalists covering last week's federal budget, had they looked, may have noticed there was no spending earmarked to help improve Canada's supply chain fluidity or rail safety. To be clear, this is not a complaint or sort of a pitch for government money. It's merely an acknowledgement of reality. Okay. All right. Well, let's take our gaze at the other party, Tim, and I'm going to stick with you and ask you to start off. How and when do the NDP get the fuck off this train? There isn't really anything in the budget that would justify them voting against it, given what they've supported up to this point. So this budget doesn't look like the jumping off point, but they need a wedge to get away from Trudeau.
I agree, and you know, I saw some news story that yesterday, the day before, about Mr. Singh musing about hasn't made up his mind, but I just viewed that as he wanted to get something in the newspaper that had his name attached to it, because to your point, when you look at all the things that you know, from disability to indigenous to food and pharma, it's all there. So it may not be perfect, but there isn't a wedge for him in this. I don't honestly know what the wedge is, but when I look forward to an election that has the potential of Trudeau versus Poilievre, you know, even in the, you know, the degree of unpopularity that Trudeau currently has, that universe feels a little scary to me if I'm, you know, part of the Singh team, because I don't have a distinctive narrative. I don't have anything to say. The progressive side is owned by the Liberals, frankly, right now against the Conservatives. I need something. I don't know what it is sitting here today, because the Liberals have basically taken everything the NDP have offered and adopted it as their own. So it's a challenge. They need to find something.
Brian?
That's not true.
All right, here we go.
Well put, brother. Let us go into the alternative universe of the way that the Democrats see the world and see what that sounds like. So first of all, let's say this. At 18 to 20%, roughly, in most federal polls, Singh is doing just fine for a federal NDP leader. Okay? Jack Layton intended to be bumbled between 16 and 18 for most of his career. Singh has actually got better polling numbers. You know, Tommy Douglas used to get, you know, 14, 15% of the vote. So you have to, let's start with expectations inside Team Orange at the federal level. Singh vote is holding up. And that's unusual for the balance of power party in a parliament that has done an accord with the government. If we think of the Liberal Democrats in Britain, for example, they had collapsed by this point in the political cycle and were in single digits and about to get clobbered. So they're holding up pretty okay. And what isn't happening is the conversion of the NDP vote over to the Liberals. Quite the contrary. There have been some federal polls recently that had those two parties within single digits of each other. One big change, and they switch places in the federal polls, and then everything is very different from the perspective of the progressive universe. Let's start with that. In terms of how they see things, look, there's no reward for the federal NDP in joining the Tories in trying to out-anger the electorate against the government that is doing a lot of things that they want. Okay, you can't compete with the Tories for being angry. If you want to be angry, there's an angry party. Okay? If you want to talk in nursery rhymes, there's a nursery rhyme party. And there's no point trying to compete with them. That's their franchise. So what's the NDP franchise? The NDP franchise that worked the best in their history was the Layton 2011 run. And that was work together to get things done. In Quebec, it was travaillons ensemble. Okay? And that theme, which is a broad appeal to progressives, works really well at the end of Liberal governments when progressive voters are looking for an alternative and they look around and they don't want to vote for the angry guy talking in nursery rhymes. And they're not necessarily going to support the Liberals. They want a positive-minded progressive who is trying to get things done. That worked really well for Layton, and that's what Singh is trying to do. Now, he's got some big problems, no doubt about it. What he doesn't have so far anyway is that the ace that wasn't seen, you know, again, 15 months before the election, that a whole lot of Quebecers, my relatives, Toibia and Quebec City, were going to take a look at him and hand him 58 seats. But what he does have is a bunch of things he can point to as, while everybody else was shouting and yelling in Parliament, he was trying to get things done, and he got them done. In terms of the timing, which is what David is raising, which is so... What you know, when is going to be the right time to dismount? It has to align with what I just said. So if your game is to say, I'm the adult in the room, everybody else is shouting and yelling, we're trying to make progress for Canadians, and then we're going to ask people for a mandate to do more, then you don't abruptly and nakedly politically take the government down before your measures are passed. Okay, so the complexity of
Parliament, except if it's Paul Martin. Sorry.
We can talk about that if you want.
I'm over it, though. I'm over it.
We all are, Brian. Not. We've moved on. See you in a dark alley someday, you bastard.
We should do a show about that sometime. But anyway, look how unhappy you are about that. Thing is trying to not play that game. Okay, so he wants his measures to get passed.
Yeah.
And then we'll see. And there's lots of different things that he can then do, okay? One of the things he could do is present more measures and say, how about this? And then run on them if the government doesn't buy it. That's one thing. I'm not saying I know they're going to do that. I'm just saying that's one thing they could do that isn't just joining Polyev and saying we want an election because it's in our partisan interests, okay? So that's their game. And so far, it has been working out okay. It's a tough map for them. Tough federal map right now is tough for them, but I've seen darker days. The federal NDP.
Well done, Brian.
Well done, but are you not worried that Polyev is going to reshape your party by who he defeats out of that caucus? He's going to run you out of rural Canada, and he's going to run the NDP out of working class Canada, and you'll be competing with the Liberals for a bunch of latte-sipping downtowners.
Well, this is the crisis of the left throughout the democratic world. Okay, the populist right is on the march all around the democratic world. Just look at Trump and look at if I can be blunt about it, look at the Nazis who are doing increasingly well in Germany. Look at the parties of the right in Poland and Finland and Sweden and Norway and the French, the Front National. And all of it is a direct appeal to working class voters saying that your progressive alignments have lost touch with you and they're off there doing what you just said, and that it is time to vote your anger, it is time to bash immigrants, it is time to do all the other stuff that those guys call and you can do. And in our nice Canadian way, that's what Mr. Polyev is trying to do here. So we're not alone in this challenge. And parties on the left have tried many things to deal with this problem. So, for example, the Social Democrats in Denmark dealt with it by adopting their opponent's key plank. The Social Democrats in Denmark said, we will shut down immigration if you elect us. And then the result, they got elected. And then that's what they did. They shut down immigration. So that's the idea of you just adopt your opponent's lines and then you blur it over and sit on top of them. In Germany, the Stoltz tried a different approach, the German Social Democrats. And what he did was he spoke, competed directly with the Nazis and the populist right for working class voters. And he appealed to them by saying, it is time for working people in Germany to be respected. And it's time for them to be respected. And that means when you're a worker, even if you don't have a university degree, that you should still be able to afford a house. You should still be able to give a decent life to your family. And in the last German election, that worked well enough to move the German SDP from third heading to fourth place in the polls to victory. So, and he left them with a feeling that they wanted from their traditional alignment, that if I vote German SDP, I'll be respected in government. It was a good effort. And the Aussie Labour is trying well. Labour in the UK is competing with the Tories for working class voters in their own way. They've helped a good deal by the incompetence of the Tories after a long run in office. And so we're all trying in different ways, but we all face the same challenge, which is that the right has figured it out, and this is nothing new, okay, it goes back to Disraeli, basically, that working people can be persuaded to vote conservative unless they see a better alternative, so you better provide one.
Ian, would you agree with me that the confidence and supply agreement has really helped Polyev because it's given him the change field all to himself?
Absolutely. Every time Mr. Singh stands up and criticizes something about the Liberal Party's record in government, NDP voters are sort of thinking, yes, and we're partly responsible for that because we've signed this agreement to keep them in office. That said, Mr. Singh comes off of a two-election kind of disaster for the NDP, right? He's lost seats in 2015 and lost seats in 2019, lost half his seats in 2015. It has been a very difficult kind of decade for the NDP. The advantage that Mr. Singh has right now is, to coin a phrase of another progressive leader, better is always possible. And as you know, this is where the conservative advantage to its right is that conservatives don't expect that much. You know, conservatives are sober about what government's possible to do and what change is possible as a result of government action and so forth. So you might have Mr. Bernier or somebody else out there yipping the yapping about something that the conservatives aren't doing. And conservative voters are like, yeah, but we don't really expect to get much out of government. Whereas on the progressive side, progressives always want something better. And so, you know, I think the pendulum is now coming back around to Singh's side after a two-election cycle where he had, where the NDP had somebody out, you know, campaigning, three-election cycle now, somebody out campaigning for, you know, the legalization of cannabis, electoral reform, tax changes for the people striving to join the middle class or whatever the phrasing was. We now have what we have, climate change. We now have what we have. Maybe it's what the Liberals were capable of, you know, government was capable of delivering on, under the Liberal brand. I'm not suggesting there's been a shortfall there. I'm suggesting it's the very dynamism of progressivism is always to want more and better. And it worked for Mr. Trudeau in 2015 and 2019. I'm not sure it did in 2021. And now it's running against him. The difficulty with Brian's assessment, and I agree with his basic assessment that Singh could run as I'm the guy who got this done for you, is the thing he got done was, I mean, to call it half-assed is an insult to people with only half an ass. a quarter-assed pharmacare plan that, you know, I mean, if you've got diabetes and you didn't have any other way of paying for the drugs and you wanted, contraception to do another way of paying for the drugs, great. Okay, I mean, I get that. But it doesn't affect even what the big public opinion polls show are people's concerns about the capacity of the healthcare system to accommodate the demands post-COVID. It's a big whiff. That, you know, he aimed at it 3 years ago for a reason or whatever, and the Liberals have gradually bargained him down from a Medicare that was going to change everything to a Medicare that might change on the margins some issues for people with diabetes or some issues for people with contraceptive needs, but that's a long way from better is always possible. At what point do they get off here? I mean, I think the better is always possible is the way off. I was frankly surprised over the course of the past month as it became clear through the Ogg inquiry that the Liberals knew that Jenny Kwan was being targeted by Chinese political foreign interference in two election campaigns and did precisely zero about it. If I were the NDP, I'd be furious about that. I don't know what's going on behind closed doors, but I was surprised to hear precisely zero from Mr. Singh about this, given that it was one of his MPs that was on the target list here. Brian's right about the angry side, but you know. If we're going to talk about income trust, we're going to talk about the Martin government's defeat in 2005. Let's go right back when Reform Party Canadian Alliance took on the Conservative merger and took on the Conservative branding. We knew, and Mr. Harper was well aware, that meant that a series of what had been solid Reform Party ridings from Skeena, Bulkey Valley all the way down through the central part of British Columbia and some seats in Saskatchewan and some seats in Northern Ontario that were competitive for us were going to be lost. And for 10 years, I mean, I don't even know what the names of those ridings are anymore because we didn't pay any attention to them. The Polyev target riding list now seems to include a bunch of ridings in the Hamilton area and a bunch of ridings in British Columbia that haven't been at play for the, you know, never for the, haven't been for the Conservative Party for a long time. Haven't been competitive except for the NDP since that 2004 merger, post-merger election. And that is trouble because, you know, Brian can be dismissive about, you know, angry kindergarten politics. It's the language of people who live in Skeena, Bulkey Valley. I don't think it's kindergarten. It's the language of people who live up in Terrace, British Columbia, and in Charlie, what's the name, sorry, in Northern Ontario, and Cochrane, and so on and so forth, and the Hamilton area, and so on. And if we come to a year from now, housing is still the most expensive it has been since Confederation in the history of the country. That people are still worried about filling up their gas tank and still worried about buying vegetables at the grocery store. Whether you call it anger or whether you call it Mickey Mouse language or whatever, it's going to be potent, and the ADP's got to get their better as always possible branding around that.
Tim, I want to just change subject a bit and draw on the threes of yours
real governing experience to try to demystify something. The Liberals have executed quite a pivot on housing. They've gone from a very passive positioning on it, where the Prime Minister was even saying it's not really our job to do this, to hyperactivity. They put a new minister in charge. They had a cabinet retreat about housing. They've come out with a plan that's big and comprehensive and has real money behind it. And how does this kind of policy pivot come about in government? Is this just the case of a talented new minister taking the ball and running with it, or did it require PMO and PCO to refocus and get engaged in an issue they hadn't been engaged in? Or how does a government go from really not showing much interest in an issue to running it like this?
So fair question. I think it's a mixture of all of those things. I think a minister who has the ability to show how it can be sold, how you can make some positive news out of a portfolio, helps convince some skeptical people that maybe there's a thing to be done. Because frankly, you know, Sean Fraser walked into some things that were had been announced well before and turned them around into, you know, social media and otherwise opportunities for the government to say at least we're doing something. Obviously, look, at the end of the day, how big a pivot the government did in terms of the amount of money it's spending, the degree of focus from the finance minister, the prime minister, the minister of housing is, the old bugaboo whole of government approach. But I mean, but they also needed to convince, some skeptical bureaucrats. As you may remember, David, long ago when we first started to do the gas tax transfer, to municipalities, that took a lot of hard slog inside government to convince, federal bureaucrats to, frankly, to be involved in something that was a direct transfer to municipalities around provinces in an area scope that the government had been, hadn't really been in and involved in. The same will be true here. I think some of the, but you'll see some of the, what I think are interesting elements in the housing, like the apartment loan program and the use of land, I think are two interesting things that actually are, this is going to be way too technical, but at the end of the day, what I really like about them is they actually use accrual accounting as a way for the government to look like it's spending a ton of money, which actually may not hurt the fisc at all. Because actually you're turning, an asset that's in one form into an asset in a different form. And so for the purpose of the federal balance sheet is still an asset. In fact, arguably putting housing on some of that vacant land may actually increase the value of the asset for the purpose of the public purse. So some of that takes, that takes the creative minds in finance and Treasury Board and PCO to be able to think about how to do that successfully. So in order for that to happen, the cabinet and the prime minister and the clerk of the Privy Council have to decide they're committing to it, and then they have to instruct all of the relevant departments to go to do the work to produce the, the proposals that then get put into a budget. So I assume sometime, probably in the fall when Fraser started to make it, look like there could be some opportunities for the government to actually do something. Plus the polling never moved. This was number one. All of that suggested a significant pivot that started last fall with it only being able to be rolled out once they had the kinds of answers that they were prepared to roll out in the context of the budget. So it's a long process, but it requires direction from the center.
And Brian, how important on an issue like that is the minister?
Well, I think the minister can be pretty important. So let's just remember that government has been in the housing business. This government has been in the housing business for quite a while. It had took a pretty big throw at housing about 5 years ago.
2017, yeah.
2017.
Yeah.
But it was all basically in the world of Bill Munro, God bless his soul. And therefore, it was basically all financial. It was a sort of a financialization of the issue. And with some, regrettable policy choices that I think led to a lot of federal money financing the construction of a lot of luxury housing in downtown Toronto. And so I think what they learned from Housing 1.0, which, when you think about it, if they had got it right then, they would have been ahead of the curve on this one.
But as it is. As it is, you know what they're going to do? they're going to make Pierre Poilievre the most successful housing prime minister in Canadian history, right? Because all these fucking things are going to get built in 2027.
They got it wrong and throw in the first throw by financialization and by focusing on luxury housing. They're closer to what you need to do here, right? Tim's absolutely right. And it's fiscally smart. You're converting one form of capital to another, land to housing, and adding the value. That's a super good thing to do. And that's how middle-class housing got built in a lot of Europe. And look at Amsterdam, look at Vienna, look at a lot of other places, right? Doing this kind of stuff is how you get on top of your housing crisis. And tragically, you know, they figured it out at what may be the last months of the government, and it may be to the benefit. Hopefully, this basic idea will not get dismantled, because it's what you actually need to do. You have to intervene directly, and to get the housing built. They finally figured that out.
Ian, you got anything to add to this?
Yeah, I'm living here in Calgary. I live not far from where the Army base was, Camp RC, which is, if I remember correctly, closed just before I left Calgary the first time in 1995 or 1996, when the Princess Patricia's and the Armored Regiment trooped up to Edmonton. That land is right on Crow Child Trail, a fantastic piece of land. I mean, part of it was handed back to the Tsutina, but the part that's in the city of Calgary was handed off to Canada Land Corporation with serviced or mostly serviced land right on a major four-lane or six-lane arterial road. When I was over there to get some gin at the distillery that's been built into the old horse barns, I see the announcement coming soon. The houses that have been built on an Army base that was decommissioned in 1995. It was a great effort by the Marty government to announce it and the Chrétien government to put the plans into effect to turn a federal asset into some housing that was much needed in 1995 in Calgary. 750,000 people later, the townhouses and stacked condo complex or whatever it is coming soon. It's 2024. That's 30 years later. I don't know what happened to the Air Force base up there just north of Yorkdale in Toronto. I think we inherited some plans for that in 2006 from the Martin government. I don't remember there ever being an announcement that any of that stuff was much going to go ahead before Mr. Harper left in 2015. I expect maybe Mr. Poilievre will get to cut the ribbon on the Downsview Air Force Base, you know, reconversion into housing or whatever. I don't know. I haven't been up there in a while. I'm so happy to be corrected. It doesn't matter who the minister is. Totally irrelevant. Sean Fraser should have used him for something more important, fisheries or something like that, where it might have made a difference. The government's budget doesn't make any difference. It's not going to go any better than the 12 billion trees that were supposed to have been planted by now, that the government's done nothing to build to plant extra trees for climate change. There's a constraint here. They let 1 million people into the country last year, put pressure on healthcare and housing with no plan to build any houses and no plan to expand healthcare capacity. Now they're going to have to live with it. And, you know, they could have subsidized something. Maybe that would have helped, or do something for fishery outposts, put Sean Fraser to fisheries and tie down some ridings in New Brunswick and in Newfoundland, pave some roads. The housing situation is unlikely to be materially better. It's possible 2025 could be the second worst year for housing affordability in the history of the country. That will be the progress that they get. That's what they're going to be running with.
So I think the cause and effect is a little off in Ian's thing. So, you know, the building, you know, frankly, with interest, we had 15, 20 years of easy money, right? Which created a certain class of ownership and housing affordability, which meant only people with a certain income could afford it. We had a population growth target that everyone agreed to, 3 or 4. Yes, there was 1 year in which, or maybe two, in which the government let in, you know, an uncontrolled number of people, basically. But that isn't, in and of itself, the reason there's a housing challenge. I think the more serious problem the government has is a bit the point Ian's making, which is, look, it's got a lot of stuff it announced. Frankly, all it's going to be able to do before the next election is maybe, you know, cut some ribbons at a putting hoarding up around a site, maybe get a backhoe. Like, no one's going to be moving into any unit that's produced by the virtue of what they've said. Maybe some, you know, those fourplexes in urban centers can get built by that. Ultimately, this only works, I think, if you get a 2, 3, maybe 4 reductions in interest rates. So if they get that and the inflation's down, I mean, obviously you got the issue of the disparity between the U.S. and Canada around interest rate potentials, given where the two economies are going. But I think if interest rates come down, that has an impact on affordability, the carrying costs of housing. They've got a bunch of stuff they can say they're doing. They're cutting ribbons. You know, municipalities are acting. There is a package of things there that says, hey, we're making things happen. Your life is more affordable. Is that going to happen? Well, you know, that's frankly, they're ultimately subject to externalities for the success of this politically.
Right. It's a scissors, though. I think the lower interest rates is certainly good for the government, because what it doesn't produce is hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of mortgage renewals at high interest rates, which was the true tsunami that was going to sweep the government away. But what it also does is it makes precisely makes mortgages cheaper and more accessible. It means more buyers in the market chasing the same supply, which bids up the price. And then we get into the world we're in now, which is that the lower interest rates just drive prices up. So this is no solution. Like, the solution is a lot more housing in the market.
Yeah, the substantive solution and the political solution aren't the same.
Yeah. All right. We're running short on your guys' time here. So I've got a few things left, and I just want to throw them at you in relatively quick order and get a quick sense from you. One of them is, if you were Trudeau, would you call a first minister's meeting on climate policy? Brian?
Yep, I wouldn't. I think the era of high noon first minister's meetings for everybody to posture, as Mr. Gretzky and Mr. Harper got this figured out, is no way to do the business of government. It only helps separatists to prove that the country doesn't work. The prime minister is onto a good dime in challenging the premiers and saying, if you don't like carbon pricing, then what's your alternative? And that's the right question to keep asking. And we don't have time to get into carbon pricing, but, you know, everyone who is saying axe the tax is only doing half the story here. The other half the story, other than forgetting about the rebate, is what then would you do? And nobody's calling them to account for that yet. It's time that they were.
You know, Tim, when I was first becoming a Liberal in like 1981 and my sense of the party was becoming established, a big part of it were the televised first minister's meetings around the Constitution, in which I would get to watch Pierre Trudeau slap around people like Brian Peckford and Sterling Lyon and be evidently the smartest person at the table and the person that represented my point of view at that table, right? Why wouldn't that same opportunity avail itself to Justin Trudeau?
Well, I guess, part of it is the issue, right? I mean, there's the broader context of that was nation building versus, you know, your little segment of the country. You know, I still remember, you know, Trudeau Pair saying, you know, someone speaks for, go over the head of the provinces to speak for, right? And yes, there can be a bit of potential for that. The real question is, will a first minister's conference produce the drama where you can win? Not clear to me that would happen around this issue. I think, you know, the issue is pretty publicly well known. You know, you've got a carbon price and a rebate. Yes, they don't have a lot of alternatives. For me, the question is, does he get the advantages, to Brian's point, of the absence of an alternative without the big national platform? And what risks come with the national platform? Maybe it doesn't come with a lot more risk than he already has. Part of me thinks at the end of the day, what they're missing in the story is selling the rebate. Not clear to me that the First Minister's Conference creates as much of an opportunity to sell what's missing in the story.
Okay. Ian, you got a thought about this?
Yeah, I do. I mean, my general rule here of thumb is never call a First Minister's Conference, period, on climate change or anything else. I think I remember watching in the opposition leader's office, you guys with the premiers at 24 Sussex on the healthcare deal to save healthcare for a generation or whatever the hell it was, I can't remember. And I sat there and looked at some other staffers and said, if we ever get into government, let's never do that. And when we when we got into government, pulled aside some public servants, you know well, I won't name them since they're public servants and they're anonymous, but they were practitioners of the Federal Provincial Arts. And I said, just so you know, we watched that on television and said, we are never doing that if we win. And both of them looked at me and said, that's good, because we were sitting in the basement saying, in the event that that Harper guy ever with, we should recommend, he should never do this. So they're on, all on the same page. That said, if you're going to have the drama like that, you have to have something to announce. And I think the path is actually fairly clear here. It's not, the carbon pricing is one thing. It's all the stuff that doesn't have a rebate attached to it, right? It's all the mandates for this, that, and the other thing by 2035, which are crazy anyway. Net zero power generation and EV sales and all this stuff. Those are the costs that people are absorbing or are going to be absorbing over the course of the next couple of years that aren't covered by the carbon tax rebate, as the Parliamentary Budget Officer has pointed out. The problem is the government has set now over the course of the last 8 years, this framing around climate change. Climate change is going to cost you a pile of money and there is no benefit to it. And they're right about that. You know, wildfires continue, poor smoke conditions continue. China continues to increase its carbon dioxide emissions at an exponential rate. We've done our part and they have not. So I would say calling a first minister's conference might be a good idea if the prime minister were going to say, look, we're not going to have any more 2035 deadlines. We're going to have a 2050, 2060 deadline, and we're only planning to meet that if everybody else meets their carbon dioxide targets or carbon emissions targets as well. Because otherwise, we're paying tens of billions of dollars for this sort of thing, and yet the forests continue to burn.
Okay. Next question. Tim, start with you about this. The Prime Minister made some news at the Foreign Interference Inquiry when he said that he didn't necessarily read every word of every intelligence document that was given to him, and that if you really wanted to ensure that he knew something, you would tell him personally. Is that normal, or did that surprise you?
It actually doesn't surprise me, to be honest with you. I'm, you know, there's a lot of paper that crosses the Prime Minister's desk. You know, I mean, I guess at the end of the day, it depends on kind of what it's stamped with and how it's framed. You know, certain kind of papers you'd always read. So, you know, but not every security briefing. But I do think that, you know, it also depends on how Prime Minister learns. Like, you know, it was Prime Minister Cretchen who famously said, don't give me more than a page, right? So I'd read a page, but don't give me 10 pages. And so I think it depends a lot on how each Prime Minister absorbs information. You know, I think the challenge a bit is, we had Katie Telford say that he read everything, then he came out and said, I didn't read everything. So that's a bit less than ideal. But I do think the notion of really getting the nuance and importance of a security issue through, you know, an oral briefing makes some sense to me. I mean, look, when I was in that chair, I'm sure the same for you, and I met with the National Security Advisor weekly, right? And yes, there was paper, but at the end of the day, it was really the discussion that highlighted the things that I needed to know on the Prime Minister's behalf in advance of the meeting with the Prime Minister, in which those things were highlighted. So, you know, Paul, as you well know, would read every piece of paper and then have the discussion. So that was the nature of him. So I think it depends on the individual, but I think at the end of the day, it's the nuance of the oral briefing that I think provides a flavor that written can't always.
Mm. Ian?
I think this issue of how the Prime Minister gets briefed was a very capable misdirection by the Prime Minister and by the Prime Minister's staff, because it's not really relevant. What's relevant is David Vigneault, the CSIS director, came back, was called back to testify again following the Prime Minister and Mr. Broadhurst's testimony at the inquiry, and he was quite clear. Everybody in government knew, because he'd briefed many, many times in private and had said in public that foreign interference in Canadian elections was a low risk, high payoff strategy for certain foreign governments, that he had briefed everybody in cabinet, individual ministers and the prime minister, that Chinese efforts during the 2019-2021 election were focused at Kenny Chu, Jenny Kwan, and then in 2021, the Aaron O'Toole national campaign. The mechanism that was set up by Mr. Trudeau to take care of all this did precisely nothing. Didn't even tell the people who were the targets of this inquiry. Jenny Kwan should be furious. Kenny Chu, I know, is furious. Aaron O'Toole was on the stand, is right to be upset about it. The only example of foreign disinformation that got any kind of action from this government was some crazy website from Buffalo that said something about Mr. Trudeau's time as a school teacher in British Columbia. And that triggered action from the clerk of the Privy Council and on behalf of the clerk of the Privy Council to Facebook to shut it down. So that, I think, is the crucial headline from this foreign interference inquiry. The entire mechanism of the gut that Mr. Trudeau set up to protect us from protect elections from foreign interference protects the prime minister from foreign political interference, and the other opposition parties hung out to dry. Mr. Vigneault said it continues to be a low risk, high payoff strategy for governments like China. And as soon as he said that, 24 hours, 48 hours later, the government leaked that their deputy minister of foreign affairs is going to go to Beijing to try and pave the way for the foreign minister to make a trip to Beijing. Again, it is a low-risk, high-payoff strategy for governments like China to screw around in our elections, because the government, as long as it takes the government responds. If it targets the opposition parties, nothing happens.
Brian, there's lots of people that like to leap on what Trudeau said about not reading the documents, because people are always looking for evidence this guy's not doing his job or he's not very interested in his job, that kind of thing. Is that what this tells us, or is this fairly normal that a person, that a government leader would say, if you really want me to know something, you're going to tell it to me personally?
I agree with what Tim said. It's all different by who it is. Rachel Notley read all her books and would go into briefings knowing the documents better than the public servants who were briefing her. I've seen other leaders who want to talk things over. But let me just say this about this topic. It's not so much what interests me is that the prime minister, but does he read or does he want to be briefed? It's the curious lack of interest by the government in this whole question of interference in elections. And it is actually a broad one, okay? There are those who want to keep it focused on the Chinese government. There's lots of interference in Canadian elections and in Canadian politics by lots of actors. And the question of how is Canadian politics funded and how are third parties funded is one that we should look at again. To his credit, Jean Chrétien was the last prime minister to really take this question seriously, and they did a major public financing reform to try to deal with it. And then we have mostly, forgive me for saying this, but because of conservatives, we have, while they're making all this noise about Chinese interference, are cheerfully cutting back all the rules that were put in to limit interference in elections. And so it's an interesting question and merits another look. Who finances political parties? Who finances third-party entities? And what can we do to shine a light on them and to limit their activity? For example, who finances the Fraser Institute? I think we'll find that China is not the only foreign country that flows money into Canada to try to influence politics.
The difference, Brian, is that the Fraser Institute didn't go out of its way to try to defeat Jenny Kwan through covert use of illegal funding into political activities of the Liberal Party. And let me tell you also, there was a Minister of Democratic Reform who tried to put the enforcement arm for Elections Canada into the Department of Justice and to bring it closer to the RCMP so it would have some muscle to take on these sort of things. That piece of legislation passed under the Harper government. The Minister of Democratic Reform was Pierre Poilievre, remember. And the first thing the Liberals did when they took office in 2015 to the Elections Act was to undo all of that additional enforcement capacity.
Lots of funny things have happened, like electoral commissioners being fired shortly after elections because people don't like what their investigations are. And so it is an all-party concern. And I guess what I'm trying to say is, this isn't just about shots, okay? That's not what we're here to do.
Understood.
Everybody who's interested in good governance should care about this matter. And that's what troubles me with the prime minister. He didn't seem to care, right? And I think we should all care, and we should look at the whole thing. And you know, the business of sending it off to a judge to go write a phone book that is going to be ignored is a bad idea. I think all political parties need to come together and think about this and think about what to do about it.
All right. Well, on that note, I want to thank the three of you for your time. This was a great conversation. I learned a lot from the three of you, as I always do. And I'm sure our viewers and listeners did too. I want to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, and our sponsor, CN Rail. And the three of you will check back in a few months. And if the Liberals haven't got those 5 points, we'll have a bunch of new stuff to talk about.
Open up the betting pool now, David.
Yeah. All right, guys. Thank you very much. Take care, Hurley Burley. See you in a week. Hurley Burley. Hurley Burley.